The McIlvaney Weekly Commentary, covering monetary, economic, and geopolitical news events.
When you get into the realm of fiscal policy, this is much more public. It is much more obvious. And politicians risk the wrath of public backlash, and they make choices that are therefore consistent with political survival, often at the expense of financial market stability. So I come back to King's question. I think it's a damn good one. Got gold?
Now here are Kevin Orrick and David McIlvaney.
Welcome to the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary. I'm Kevin Orrick along with David McIlvaney. Just a reminder, we are gathering questions for our annual weekly commentary question and answer session. So please send us your questions to info@McIlvaney.com. Dave, it's been a year of acronyms, if nothing else. I mean, C-19, PPP loans, MMT, UBI, they're talking about at this point, and then QE4, QE5, QE6, QE to infinity. Living in this day and age, you really do need to know what the acronyms stand for because they do have an effect on your life. But before we get to the acronyms, I did notice it's a little cheaper to go to Europe to get the Pfizer vaccine than here in America. What's up with that?
Well, not only does the ECB want to see a lower euro, and of course there's some trade advantages to doing that, but they also don't mind paying lower prices for the vaccines. According to the Washington Post, we're paying here in the United States 24% more for the vaccine than in Europe. And that's from an American company. So I guess we can say thank you. Merry Christmas, Pfizer. Much appreciated. No comment on pandemic profiteering, at least not right now.
You remember when Trump was saying, you know, people are going to be paying their fair share. I think we've probably lost that again, you know, with NATO and the IMF. It seems like the Americans always pay a little bit more. But speaking of paying a little bit more, we've been talking about inflation, and a lot of times people are like, well, there's really not inflation. Using the acronym CPI, okay, consumer price inflation, or maybe looking at the food price index, we have had inflation if you look at the last 20 years, haven't we?
Well, sure. And, you know, some of the favorite measures of the Fed have moved up from the low 1.3, 1.4 levels to 1.9. We're knocking on their target. And of course, they had moved already from a 2% flat target to an average rate, giving themselves the flexibility going forward to shoot for higher numbers, kind of like aiming above a target if you're at a gun range. Aim above so you can actually hit the target if you're far enough distance. So, you know, you look at the chart of the World Food Price Index. This is put together by the UN. And, you know, this goes back in time to include the major moves higher from 2000, 2002, when commodities were really left for dead. And prices moved higher. In fact, they moved higher up through 2008 and again spiked in around 2011. And then commodity prices stabilized. They stabilized at a higher level, about 50% higher than the launching point of the major commodity cycle. Again, that 10-year period, 2000 to 2010. And so new plateau, I guess you could view it as that. And prices have now begun to rise off of that higher base, off of that plateau, and appear to be breaking out to higher levels. Robust global demand has yet to return in force, so it's not necessarily because we see a healthy economy driving demand for commodities. And so we're kind of left with a present tense stagflationary setup, and this might dissipate. If you have a reopening of businesses and enterprise here in the United States and globally, you could certainly eliminate the stag part of stagflation. But I think we've got a growing trend accelerating, in fact, the inflation part.
You know, we talk about seeing what really impacts us, even if it's an acronym, but you'll remember the GFC, right? The global financial crisis. We had commodity price spikes right before that. And, you know, that ultimately led to political changes, especially in the Middle East, didn't it?
Well, we had the European debt crisis shortly thereafter, just 3 years later. So a major commodity price spike preceding the global financial crisis in 2008 and the European debt crisis 3 years later. Of course, there was a primary catalyst in there with an increased cost in food for the Arab Spring, one of the great social and political recalibrations that this generation has witnessed, particularly in the Middle East. It's worth considering the rise in essential goods in the context of stagnating economic activity, which is more or less what we have now. Because should that continue, you're going to see the policy conversation revolve more and more, and the attitude around universal basic income or UBI, I think you're going to see it move from a conversation towards policy implementation. Now, of course, there's worrying consequences for a deficit, total debt levels and currency implications as well.
Well, Dave, I've worked for your family for many years, 3 decades, and I've had to work. But it looks like from this point forward, UBI is going to take care of me. Thank you. It was fun.
Yeah, well, we'll see. I mean, we'd love for you to have whatever financial freedom you want. I have some question as to the viability and the real benefit in terms of that universal basic income. I see that theme coming up more often in the news media. And, you know, The Economist puts together kind of a year in preview. And in that particular edition from The Economist, they've got a 2021 article by Stockton, California mayor. And this particular mayor is making the case that a guaranteed income is what Americans need. And, you know, to me, if it's not a guarantee of devaluation, I don't know what is. When you think about it, devaluation can be applied to many different things. Devaluation of the currency, devaluation of human capital, devaluation of creativity, devaluation of the innovation and change that you see within a normal market system. And so I guess you have to be careful what you wish for. If you want something that is a free lunch, number one, there is no such thing. And number two, the cost may not be only financial, but you might be looking at the breaking of a national spirit and a devaluation of who we are as a people.
I think sometimes partisanship would make you think that it's the other side that has caused this. But actually, you've got both sides, Republicans and Democrats, that have enjoyed this period of time where the Federal Reserve can just print and print and print. You were talking about devaluation. I can't imagine a universal basic income without devaluation of the currency. But, you know, one of the things that has stayed low, and this is really interesting, you know, to drive past the gas station and see $2 gas right now, that just reminds me of decades ago, Dave. So we don't really have inflation in fuel costs. Is that attributable to some of this flooding the economy with liquidity? And what would you say the almost deflation of fuel costs, what caused that?
Yeah, I mean, on the bright side, and this is where when you look at universal basic income and the cry for guaranteed income and the problems of a stagnating economy, it's the stagnating part of the economy which is driving demand destruction in terms of fuel, both for driving and for flying. And of course, a lot of that's attributable to COVID. So I guess you could say on the bright side, fuel costs remain well below the levels that helped add to food and transport costs and that escalation that we saw 2007 and 2008 most dramatically. We're talking $140 a barrel for a barrel of oil. We're at 65% below those levels. So you're right. I think the elephant in the room right now is the scale of central bank liquidity in the financial system coupled with credit expansion in the corporate and commercial banking sectors. And of course, those are all complements of artificially low rates. And so we're awash in trillions and trillions of dollars. And it's not just here in the United States. You could go region by region. Europe, certainly the ECB has accommodated and continues to flood that part of the world with money. Chinese aggregate financing this year is another great case in point. Aggregate financing for the year 2020 exceeds $5 trillion. November, right on track, $326 billion dollars in credit creation in China. That's November alone. And so you see things like M2, which we've talked about in terms of US M2. Chinese M2 through November is at $4.487 trillion. Okay, that's pretty significant. That's pretty significant. And they've pulled ahead of US M2 growth, which is at $3.779 trillion. So call it $3.8 trillion here in the US. Just for frame of reference, 2009 was $900 billion in terms of M2 growth versus the close to $4 trillion or $3.8 we have today. 2018 was $393. So, you know, I mean, if you look at what we're running today in terms of growth of money supply, we're running about 10x, tenfold in 2 years. And I mean, and that's not even to mention the, you know, $3 trillion plus in the budget deficit, $3 trillion in QE. I mean, this is creating a curious environment, monetary backdrop to implement fiscal policy stimulus.
I remember when Reagan said we're all Keynesians now, and you and I probably would say no, we're not Keynesian. But I remember when I was in school and we were taught Keynesian economics as if it was the standard. And I remember there were two things. There was the monetary policy, which is what we've seen with the Federal Reserve, which of course is printing money and altering interest rates. But I also remember the other component that hasn't really kicked in fully right now, and that's fiscal stimulus. These stimulus packages from COVID, I don't know if you count that. Do you count that as fiscal stimulus, Dave?
Exactly. And maybe we're not all Keynesians now because we're neo-Keynesians. And you can be neo, that's new Keynesians, if you are into the modern monetary theory equivalent of, you know, how you get fiscal stimulus into the system without worrying about inflation, deficits, et cetera. Fiscal stimulus is more of a direct feed into the economy than the monetary variety. The monetary variety seems to circulate resources in financial assets primarily. And so the benefit stays cloistered with leveraged speculators to a larger degree. Fiscal policy, on the other hand, those measures go more directly to people and to businesses, small businesses. And there's a cause of, I guess you could say that there's more of a money velocity impact. You've got wages, you've got payroll. And these things are more directly visible within the economy. So potentially greater economic activity and less asset price mania. That would be the contrast maybe between monetary stimulus and fiscal stimulus. And if you look back to this last week, note that Jerome Powell's latest Fed comments underscored the importance of transitioning towards that very thing, towards fiscal stimulus, away from what he does and more towards what Janet Yellen will get to do once Mr. Mnuchin is retired, along with Donald Trump. And, you know, of course, this is no way saying that the Fed is backing away from their current quantitative easing involvements. We're talking $120 billion total. They're not abandoning the $80 billion in monthly Treasury purchases. They're not abandoning the $40 billion in monthly mortgage-backed securities. I mean, in case you're wondering how we arrived at 2.67% on a 30-year fixed mortgage, you can thank your pal. That is Jerome Powell. He is a pal. The financial markets today, I think, are at risk in that if we follow Powell's prescription and move towards fiscal stimulus, we've now got a different kind of decision-making body. And this is a decision-making body that doesn't have the agility that the Fed or the Fed chairman does. So again, decisions in the Senate, decisions in the House, these are not unilateral. They're not speedy. Certainly is not as speedy as what you'd find with that small group of folks at the Fed.
Isn't it amazing how trillions now don't sound as large as they used to? You know, I'm going to liken this to when you have a toothache and you take painkillers that are prescribed. You can go to the dentist and sweet talk the dentist, you think, into more painkillers, but they hear it all the time. Every surgeon hears, you know, their patients come and say, you know what, I'm hurting. Could I just get a little bit more? And, you know, you look at Washington, just the very thought of being able to put stimulus into the economy. What that really is, it's saying pork belly, pork belly, pork belly. And, you know, the stimulus plan that came out here just recently, that was scaled back, and it's still, what, almost $2 trillion bucks.
Well, and so, you know, you have this issue of aggregate demand going back to, are we all Keynesians now? And, you know, to not concede that we are Keynesians, there is the argument that aggregate demand, if you're not going to see the private sector pull their own weight, which they have not in the context of COVID, then you have to have the public sector do that. So you get deficit spending, and that's where you see, you know, hold the economy together, spend what you have to, it's only temporary. And, you know, again, we come back to the decision making in the Senate and the House and the speed at which it takes things, particularly when things are polarized, when they're very partisan. And, you know, as we've seen in recent months, how long did it take for us to arrive at a scaled down stimulus bill? And this was originally promoted by Democrats at twice the size of the one that was delivered this week. So $892 billion delivered. They were angling for $1.7 trillion. with lots of handouts to desperate cities and municipalities, did not get that. So again, compromised to 892 with the B versus 1.7 with the T. And it was a long process of political bickering. They're all fiddling around and ultimately compromising on something that's generally considered, at least by the markets, underwhelming. And so that fiddling in the context of an economic fire, you know, or imagine if it's not an economic fire, but a market contagion, imagine how that fiddling could accelerate market downside. Politics and policy measures, I think, are very dangerous elements in an already vulnerable financial system. And it's really worth keeping that in mind. It boils down to the market's having a certain set of expectations and there being a mismatch in terms of when those things can be delivered and how they're delivered. Meeting the market's voracious appetite for ever-increasing capital is becoming more difficult on the current scale. And then if you do, at some point, let's say first quarter of this next year, layer in a veneer of liquidity crisis or solvency crisis or any sort of tightening in financial conditions, now you've got the market hare with a certain set of expectations dependent for survival on the government tortoise, who's yeah. operating as they do, but it's not necessarily going to be helpful in a time frame that the hare expects.
For those who think I misspoke when I said $2 trillion and you said, no, it's only $892 billion, I think we both would agree. All it's going to take is somebody yelling fire, the next crisis, right? Let's just see by this time next year what the fiscal stimulus package really was. I'm wondering if 2021 is going to have the 2020 reputation. But $892 billion, is that the largest we've had before? Where does that scale as far as what we've done in the past?
Yeah, it's the second largest package in U.S. history. And, you know, for market speculators, it was not enough for them to get up and dance. For small business owners, roughly a third of the stimulus is like the PPP forgivable loans we saw in the last giveaway. About 32% of the total is more direct to households, split between added unemployment benefits and direct checks to qualifying households. Not everybody qualifies, but for those that do, again, roughly a third is going to be direct stimulus that way. And then the last third is kind of a hodgepodge. I mean, you've got things in there for vaccine distribution, you know, $82 billion, which is about 9% of the total for HVAC repair. So if you're talking about the filtration, air systems, air conditioning, heat, ventilation, whatever, you get to replace those. There's other aid to schools and daycare, a little bit of money to craft distillers, want to keep them alive, make sure people have at least one reason to smile. Money for NASCAR tracks.
NASCAR tracks.
Of course.
Money for, well, okay. So distillers and NASCAR tracks. Interesting. They needed money for that in the stimulus package.
Yeah. I still think one of the best investments someone could make if they really thought we were heading for hard times is probably a small still. Become your own, you know, garage craft distiller. Now, you know, there's money flowing to NASCAR and to Amtrak. And it really what it reflected was for that last part of stimulus, if you had an arm that could stretch a little bit higher and stand out from the crowd there on K Street, you know, where all the lobbyists hang out, then you got the money. So if you had a longer arm, then you got recognized and you got written into, I forget the number of pages. It was close to 5,600 pages in this particular bill. So a few details. Anyways, Washington Post describes K Street as the brainstem of Washington, the medulla oblongata of Washington, the reptilian part of the brain that automates circulation, breathing, and contributes to overall sentience. And if it's malfunctioning, causes imbalance, dizziness, and vomiting. And it's true. If you think about when lobbyists aren't happy, you know, there's all kinds of stink that gets raised. And they're just, you know, basically speaking for constituents. The fascinating thing is I actually thought that's what our representatives were supposed to do, is be in touch with the people, not the K Street lobbyists, as representatives of government and not special interests. But anyways, I digress. Oh, we also get two Smithsonian museums.
No.
And we get an anti-doping program for horse racing. That's built in. which is a little ironic if you think about, you know, what we want to do to control substances for horses, but state by state, we're granting freer access to narcotics for humans.
Yeah, as we record in Colorado, but the horses, they can't drug. The horses can't drug. Okay, so I'm going to shift here, and we're going to talk a little bit about politics, and that always gets people's ire up.
Before we do, Kevin, I think one of the things that's important to point out, because this is not, you know, the inflation boogeyman is not a boogeyman. You know, and when we start talking about the stag part of inflation or the inflation part of stagflation, you know, you look at gold up 23.9% year to date, and that can mean a variety of things because gold is a metal for a variety of seasons and it moves on for a variety of reasons. But when you look at silver up 45.3%, when you look at copper up 30%, it supports the idea that inflation expectations have already shifted. And now you've just got the market playing catch up to where the market speculator says, yeah, I think I know what I see. And I think I know what these implications are. And I think you have a better position now. Again, you know, gold being up, you could have that in response to a stock market decline. Actually, gold can do just fine in the context of deflation. But when you get the complementary moves by silver and copper, you need to think, what else is going on here? What else is going on here?
I think it is important to remember that we had years where we talked about Dr. Copper. And Dr. Copper, which is a great inflation leader for us, was telling us that we weren't going to have inflation. Now Dr. Copper is really speaking. And so on the political side, Dave, because I think most people here in the United States are sort of sick of the cancel culture and this whole far left progressivism. I the people who even voted Democrat, I don't know that they're really identifying with what the press is telling us identifies this next administration coming in. Are we playing with fire as a nation right now by thinking that it was the far left that won?
You know, sometimes you got to move outside the United States to get a healthy perspective. Love talking to my dad on occasion as he has lived. Me and my mom lived in Asia for better part of 20 years now. And, you know, there was, from that outsider perspective, a fascinating article in the Financial Times by Edward Luce. And it was an interesting article. It was basically warning Biden and his incoming administration to steer clear of identity politics and to steer clear of far left progressivism. And, you know, he pointed out, he said, look, you've got 74 million Trump votes, you've got the loss of 10 seats in the House of Representatives to the GOP. You've got failure by the Democrats to regain a single state legislature. And what he was concluding was that while Biden won the White House, in stark contrast, the Democrats down ballot lost. So the warning is to recognize that a lot of Americans are not interested in fringe left ideas, not interested in embracing identity politics. That's not a winning strategy. And so again, it's kind of like, well, do you want to lose your soul to a strategy that may in fact, you know, stir up a base in ways that you've never imagined possible? And it's funny because that kind of a memo from Edward Luce has not gotten passed quickly enough. You've got Time Magazine in the last week, you know, has Helen Keller described as just another privileged white person. Mm. It's Helen Keller. I mean, you get a grip. This is at the far end of absurdity. Okay, so this is how she's going to be understood in the writing of modern day history. Helen Keller's just another privileged white person. And then we go to Newsom, Gavin Newsom's hometown in San Francisco, and they've come up with what almost feels like a Truth and Reconciliation Committee, and they're renaming as many public buildings as they possibly can, including Abraham Lincoln High School, because the former president didn't adequately demonstrate that Black lives mattered to him. And that issue of not mattering enough, that Black lives didn't matter enough to Abraham Lincoln, was actually one of the comments from the gentleman who's sort of leading this charge, the first grade teacher or something. Now, ironically, this made me laugh. And if there's anything that is sort of I love this. Ironically, Dianne Feinstein is also on the building docs list, which is just an amazing testament to what or who is defined as acceptable by the far left.
So the politics seems like it's just ridiculously out of control, or at least those types of things. But last week you were talking about valuations. I'm going to go back to the markets, because when you just flood the markets with trillions of dollars, things go crazy. It's like you said, you can devalue a lot of things in a lot of ways. But when you take out the scarcity of money, or you take out the ethics of a political viewpoint, it devalues everything. And, you know, going back to valuations, you talked last week about how the stock market is radically overvalued. If you look at, you know, Tobin's Q, you look at price earnings ratio, we're in the 100th percentile on a lot of these measures. Yet people right now are still saying, give me stocks.
Yeah. So maybe we're back to a less crazy topic in a sense. You've got last week, Bloomberg covers Bank of America. Bank of America is pointing out another sell signal for stocks. And you're right, we've been talking about this for a number of weeks. The valuations are sky high. And what they were pointing out is that investors are now underweight cash on the one hand, and fund managers have reached the most bullish sentiment levels on risky assets since 2011. So call it almost 10 years. Cash is at an average at or below 4%. And I suppose if you thought about sort of a poker game, the all-in is that time when you confidently push all your chips to the middle of the table. And sometimes in poker, it's a bluff. But in the stock market, it's usually a sign of delusional expectation and conviction in the stock market. And it generally coincides with a major market correction. So, you know, risk on, that idea that we should just be putting the pedal to the metal, no reason for caution here. That continues to be the trend in the stock market and in the options markets. With, frankly, the probability of even higher highs into the year end, we've got low volume, we've got lots of people on vacation coming into the holiday week and through the new year. So if you want to, you can actually take a very little bit of money and push things even higher. But again, in the backdrop, political partisan bickering, you know, valuation metrics to the moon. So these things in contrast, I think, are going to be challenging. What we don't have yet are any real technical divergences, you know, where you might have the price trending higher, but a number of technical indicators already turning down. We don't have those technical divergences yet, but if we get any divergences in early January, and that could be first 2-3 weeks of January, there will be blood in the streets. So my view is that dry powder, you know, having 25-30% of a position in cash coming into the first quarter, that first quarter of 2021, not only are you going to do yourself a favor in terms of having calmer nerves, not only are you going to do yourself a favor in terms of limiting downside, but you're also going to empower more attractive purchases if you're in the mood to own something a little cheaper.
A little earlier, you said that we can thank Jerome Powell and actually probably all the central bankers for the low mortgage rates. But one of the indicators in the market as to risk is interest. It always has been the interest that's paid on debt. But if the central banks are buying everything and lowering the interest rates because they're just the buyer of first and last resort, it really is attractive to go out and borrow money. And, you know, maybe for a mortgage that works. But the credit markets have grown so amazingly complacent, Dave, because they know the Fed's got their back. They can borrow any amount of money and the Federal Reserve will buy. Do you see that reversing at any time? And, you know, so it's not just stocks that are overvalued. In a way, it's bonds, isn't it?
Yeah, and we spent a good bit of time in this week's portfolio manager meetings, Doug Noland pointing out that, look, you've got stock markets at all-time highs. Meanwhile, the VIX, measure volatility, and the look at who is hedging, so to say, their downside, is stubbornly high. So you would expect generally to see stock markets at all-time highs and the VIX receding to lower levels, indicating real calm. But there's concern. There's enough concern amongst professional investors to say, yeah, we're bullish, but we're also covering our bets. And it's very expensive to cover your bets in this market environment. Meanwhile, the contrast is with the credit markets, where you look at credit default swap spreads, and they are not stubbornly high like the VIX has been. Even as we've gone to new highs in the stock market and the VIX has stayed pretty elevated, credit default swap spreads, that is what it costs to insure against default, very, very low. You know, I would say roughly 1/3 of where it was at the peak numbers we saw earlier this year. And, you know, even though they've inched higher in recent weeks, you're talking about very insignificant moves off of a very low level. So the credit markets, I think they have a more measured confidence as they count the already committed dollars. And those committed dollars were reaffirmed by Jerome Powell last week and reaffirmed by the European Central Bank the week before. Remember, we mentioned the $2.2 trillion joint effort by the European countries and another $500 billion in QE from the ECB. Well, Powell said, yeah, we're on the hook. We know we'll do $100 billion, $120 billion a month. And then in last week's comments, he also said, and we will not surprise you. There's going to be no surprises.
So he's going to give warning. They'll hear the train coming, like we talked about, a long ways off before he tapers. Is that what you're saying?
Exactly. The warning is going to come long before the taper, according to Powell. And so it was interesting, after our commentary played last week, you know, we were discussing low rates and how in an environment of low rates, you can work your way towards justification of higher valuations. And that's precisely what Powell said. He said, I quote, admittedly, PEs are high. That's price earnings ratios. But that may not be as relevant in a world where we think the 10-year treasury is going to be lower than it's been historically, end quote. So that was my point last week is, you know, once you get to these elevated levels, you start doing mental gymnastics to figure out why and how you can justify people being in the market today and adding to their positions, even at elevated levels. But, you know, we also had one market commentator who's been actively trading the market since 1994. He said this: Powell likes stock valuations based on the Fed model. And then he does a little historical on this. He says the Fed model has liked valuations without exception since 2002.
Well, and see, that's for the guy who can print money, which is where Powell's at, then he's going to be able to talk about whatever model he wants. But, you know, one of the things that we have in the stock market, and I'm glad we do, is rules that basically say if you're an executive in a particular company and you're higher up, you have to report when you're selling stock. Sometimes, you know, it's a little like looking at a betting line for a political election. You can get more information out of how people are placing their money than what the official polls are saying. And I think, you know, when you look at the private sector and you start to see some of these executives selling their stock, which is what's happening right now, that should give a person an idea of where the valuations are.
Yeah, I think it's important to note that we're not the only ones who are critical of these valuations. You had two different JP Morgan analysts who this week were basically saying, look, the equity rally is overdone. They were looking specifically at small and mid-cap stocks. And, you know, then they went on to reference the global market cap to global GDP. Remember last week we mentioned the Buffett ratio, where you take all of the value of listed companies, their capitalization, add that up and compare it to the size of the domestic economy where they operate. And that gives you the quote unquote Buffett ratio. Well, this is like, you know, a larger version of it, the global version of the Buffett ratio, all stocks in the world divided by the entire global economy. And these guys were saying, look, yeah, we don't like where small and mid-cap stocks are. And by the way, the global market cap to global GDP gets above 100%. And now we're at all-time highs. And, you know, says that number one, the rally is overdone. And number two, a correction is likely to ensue. So, yeah, I guess one question I have, is it any surprise? Does it surprise you that insider selling in the month of November, we're here at 2.5 to 3-year highs, where, you know, again, coming into the Christmas holiday season, insiders never look a gift horse in the mouth. If you're going to have a speculative frenzy and melt up, why not sell into it as much as you can?
And fortunately, if you're looking a gift horse in the mouth, it won't be doped anymore because of the stimulus package. So the gift horse basically is cleaner than we are. But as for the dollar, you know, we had a guest on, Dave, that we read his book, Barry Eichengreen, He wrote the book Exorbitant Privilege, and he was talking about the U.S. dollar and the positives and the negatives of being a reserve currency. He's out talking right now. He's trying to talk up the dollar as it's falling. Why the timing?
You know, I think to some degree, you find academics who feel like they need to sort of lean against the wind. So whatever the trend and comment is, you know, it's all right to be the iconoclast, to have the different opinion. When you talk about the U.S. dollar, it is a little odd to find a defense of dollar stability and supremacy coming from Barry Eichengreen this week. So, you know, why does he comment? The U.S. dollar is, if you look at a chart, trading at levels we last saw late 2017, early 2018. And the move lower at that point, late 2017, early 2018, had emboldened Jerome Powell to begin thinking about a tapering and to actually shrinking the Fed balance sheet. That's what he began doing. And he looked like a very different kind of Fed president than we'd had in a long time. So he's shrinking the scale of QE. And then by the third quarter of 2018, you've got the equity markets despairing for lack of more free money. And then there in Q4, you know, it just got unpleasant, right? We saw the about face from Powell in January of 2019 as the markets had already sold off over 20% there in November, December. But the dollar had been stabilized. If you go back in time a little bit more, right, the dollar had been stabilized from its downturn from Powell's tough talk and his follow through on action there in 2018.
Yeah, but now the dollar's back down to those levels. I mean, it takes us back to what, 2017?
Yeah, the 2017, 2018 lows. And that's what makes this interesting, because Eichengreen is certainly no friend of dollar supremacy. You mentioned exorbitant privilege. He'd like to see that simply go away, U.S. dollar having reserve currency status. And he argues that uncertainty related to COVID will keep a floor into the dollar, even with vaccines and things of that nature. There's still enough concern that any resolution removing uncertainty is going to cause a negligible unwinding of those safe haven purchases of the dollar. So nothing that would justify a 20% decline from here. So he's basically saying, no, look, if the world gets better, you know, we're still fine. Second, he points to US QE as a potential catalyst for downside, but then counters that by saying the ECB is far more committed to a lower euro and thus has QE or quantitative easing in place that should in fact be dollar supportive.
That's called the race to the bottom, isn't it?
That's right. It's stronger on a relative basis. And that's what's crazy here is whoever thought that less currency debauchery on a relative basis was the basis for currency, in this case, US dollar strength. And I guess maybe that's not a surprise coming from Berkeley and the economics department at Berkeley.
Over the last 6 weeks or so, you've continued to repeat what Stephen Roach was concerned about, and that is, what's the dollar look like in 2021? He said he saw a devaluation as much as 35%.
Right. And of course, he was looking at the current account deficit as the primary catalyst for that. And no surprise that Barry Eichengreen picks up on that and he turns to both the twin deficits. You know, again, Roach was particularly concerned about the record current account deficits. But Barry says people have been concerned about the budget and current account deficits for a long time. They've been predicting a dollar crash on that basis for a long time. It hasn't happened yet. It's not going to happen. Don't worry about it. So that's kind of how he just walks past what to Stephen Roach is a big deal coming into 2021. And then on the last point, and I agree with him on this last point, he basically says, although our geopolitical stature is in question and has been challenged, there's no viable alternative to dollar hegemony. It's not the Chinese RMB. It's not the euro. And even as central banks and the Bank of International Settlements begin their launch of central bank digital currencies, that is not a substitute for the U.S. dollar either. And just a quick comment on that idea of a central bank digital currency. It's worth noting that this is not an adoption process of Bitcoin, and this is not an adoption process of Ethereum. You might recall that we've often quoted Ken Rogoff, who basically said something to the effect of what the private sector innovates, government regulates, and ultimately What was his last word?
They take it over.
Exactly. And I forget the exact word that he used. But that's more or less what we see is a co-opting of the technology. Central bank digital currencies are moving forward. They're in the adoption phase with multiple central banks. But even with that in motion, that's not something that Barry Eichengreen's concerned about, in part because there's a number of potential issues with the CBDCs, that is the central bank digital currencies, their impact on the commercial banking space and intermediation, which has not been solved. And so, again, bottom line there is there's no alternative. Where we disagree is on the first three points. So considerable dollar decline does not mean that reserve currency status is lost. So again, go back to that dollar chart, the U.S. dollar chart, which I was, you know, referencing, and you can just imagine it hitting lows in 2017 and 18, rallying strongly, and then returning to those same levels now.
It's dropped to 89, hasn't it? I mean, in the last short period of time, we've seen it drop below 90.
That's right. We've seen it trade to 89 and change. And the next support level is 85. That may hold, if not 80. And then we go back to the lows we had a decade or so ago in the 70s. And so it would seem actually that Stephen Roach's script for the dollar in 2021 may not be far off. It may, in fact, be in motion as we speak. It certainly is not as far-fetched as Eichengreen would make it seem. So we are, if you compare the period now versus 2016, 2017, leading to that period of dollar decline, we are in a far worse economic shape than we were in 2016 and 2017. Look, we got small and medium-sized businesses collapsing, and maybe these Paycheck Protection Program checks will buy enough time to allow the consumer confidence to revive and retail to return. Yeah, but this is now the multi-trillion dollar question. How low will the dollar decline before the Fed is forced to act? And they're going to have to choose one thing or the other. When the Fed is forced to act in this next row of dollar decline, they're going to either have to protect the bond market and enter the money printing doom loop, or they sacrifice the leveraged speculator and the debtor on the altar of higher rates. And so what do they want to preserve? The value of the dollar or stability in the bond market?
See, that's the thing that we've been looking at and wondering for years, and that is, do we reach a point where the Fed has to either save the dollar or save the bond market? There is a point when you go too far into debt and you're intervening on everything that you either sacrifice the currency, which would be a collapse of the dollar or at least a severe devaluation of the dollar, or a collapse of the bond market with interest rates skyrocketing. So what's your thought on that?
Yeah, you know, I think Bill King summarizes it well. He says that bonds, which have been in a grand super cycle bull market since 1982, will enter a bear market gradually at first. Then at some point, bonds will probably experience the suddenly collapse. And I think he's referring back to that, how did you go broke slowly, then all at once? Yeah, I think that was from a dialogue in a Hemingway book. But yeah, so back to Bill King's comment. Then at some point, bonds will experience the suddenly collapse. At that point, the Fed will be at the Rubicon. It must decide if it will save the dollar or bonds. The Fed will have to monetize everything and destroy the dollar or hike rates to save the dollar. The Fed's Sophie's choice will be dictated by politics and public sentiment. And he ends that quote by saying, or asking the question, got gold?
Yeah, got gold. And Bill King's not necessarily a gold bug, but he's basically saying you better have it.
Well, and so returning to the idea earlier, what makes this next chapter in financial market history so tense, what makes it so dicey, is that politics operates according to a different set of priorities than money, a different set of priorities than market or financial logic, where monetary policy you can very subtly designate winners and losers. When you get into the realm of fiscal policy, this is much more public. It is much more obvious. And politicians risk the wrath of public backlash, and they make choices that are therefore consistent with political survival often at the expense of financial market stability. So this is where the adventure is. This is where the adventure is. What awaits us in 2021 is the merging of financial market dysfunction with social and political dysfunction in an age where institutional trust has already eroded. So I come back to King's question. I think it's a damn good one. Got gold?
You've been listening to the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary. I'm Kevin Orrick along with David McIlvaney. And just remember, you can send us your questions for the annual question and answer program here on McIlvaney Weekly Commentary. Just send those questions to info@McIlvaney.com, McIlvaney.com. And you can call us at 800-525-9556.
This has been the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary. The views expressed should not be considered to be a solicitation or a recommendation for your investment portfolio. You should consult a professional financial advisor to assess your suitability for risk and investment. Join us again next week for a new edition of the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary.